Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Frank Rodriguez, a much-loved counselor of troubled teens, lies dead on the bedroom floor. His wife and stepdaughter are in shock, and so is the medical examiner when he performs the autopsy. Aside from being dead, Frank is in perfect health. Demanding to know the cause of her husband's death, Angie Rodriguez badgers the police, insisting that Frank was murdered. The cops attribute her assertions to overwhelming grief, but soon they too believe that Frank didn't die of natural causes. When the police enlist their number one suspect to help in the investigation, things spiral out of control until police are dealing with a daring plot to murder Angie's best friend, and allegations of another homicide so evil and perverse that even seasoned L.A. County detectives are shocked beyond belief. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Taste for Murder, with my special guests, journalist and authors Burl Bear and Frank C. Gerardo. Welcome to the program, gentlemen, and thank you for agreeing to this interview.
Well, it's a thrill and a delight to be on the number one true crime program out of Canada.
Yeah, thank you. Speaking as a son of Canadian parents, I'm happy to be on the show with you and Burl.
Well, I just want to downplay my Canadian background here, if I can, because here we are in all things more interesting in terms of true crime and this incredible story set in California. Now, of all the stories that you gentlemen could choose, why did you choose this story?
Frank has the answer to that one.
Well, it really stemmed from an investigation I did as a reporter. We looked at unsolved homicides in Los Angeles County. And first we had to look at all the homicides that occurred. There was 11,242 homicides in an 11-year period from 2000 to 2010. And, you know, the way that people were killed ran the gamut of the way people are killed, you know. There was shootings and stabbings and beatings and strangulations and suffocations. And you go through this whole list of things, but only one of those 11,242 was poisoned. And that was our victim. And we looked at this and said, oh my God, this is really unique. How do you end up not only being murdered by poisoned, but having that case come to the attention of homicide detectives in the Los Angeles County Coroner? And that's where we started.
You know what I found in context surprising about that is that one time poison was the number one weapon of choice in homicide, especially after life insurance was invented. When life insurance was invented and there was not yet a test for arsenic, people were having policies taken out on them by their moms, their dads, their brothers, their sisters, and then miraculously dropping dead. And poison was the number one mode of killing people, especially in England, for quite a while. But it's kind of, you know, went out of style, like naming your kid Brittany or something.
or it's still in style, and there's just so many other deaths occurring that they don't take the time to actually figure out, you know, how someone died when it doesn't appear to be overly suspicious.
Well, yeah, you're certainly right about that, because if Angie hadn't kept badgering the cops, gee, I think someone killed him, 18 months later it all would have been over with. You know?
Yeah, I think that's true, and she probably would have been cashing a check.
Yeah. Instead, she's sitting around looking like Jabba the Hutt.
Okay, gentlemen, let's go back for those people that have no idea what this story is,
what
other than our little the brief synopsis that I read. So let's go back to Angie, Angelina, and where she grew up in in Rockaway, and so let's talk about her upbringing in Queens and her grandfather. And so let's go right back to see if we can find out how on earth some of this happened, and let's talk about her early childhood in Queens. Burl,
you want to go first, Frank, or you want me to go?
Go ahead, Burl.
Okay, a lot of people assume because of the name that she is Hispanic or Mexican-American or something. Actually, she's not. She's Italian-American, Catholic. Her forefathers and foremothers, several of them, came over from Italy in the 1800s. Part of the family settled in New York. Some of it settled in Puerto Rico. And that's where she was. Her father was not around much. He drove taxi, drove truck, drove people crazy, and he was drinking and getting in trouble and wasn't around much. It was, as it is now, not a very pleasant area. They built these projects that people moved into, and there was a great deal of prejudice against the people living in these projects or moving into them. There was, in the book we have some actual quotes from that era talking about, well, these people bring laziness and sloth with them, as part of their life. That's the reason the projects are so bad, is it's built into their DNA to be worthless, that kind of uplifting stuff. And it was in this environment that she grew up with a very hardworking mother. And you would think a support group of aunts, uncles, grandparents, and other grandkids. Unfortunately, the support wasn't very supportive. If there was a safety net of family and friends, and that had some rather large holes in it. One of the biggest a-holes in the family was, of course, the grandfather. Now, from a writing standpoint, Frank and I had a discussion about this, and then being as you're a journalist also, Dan, bring you in. We had a discussion about the wording of Grandpa's interaction with the children. Frank originally wanted to soften it up a bit, what I call softening it up, by stating that Angie was the victim of sexual abuse by the grandfather or inappropriate sexual behavior. I wanted it stronger than that, and here's why. When you're writing a newspaper story, you would use something such as that because that's factual. I think, however, when you're dealing with a story, when you're telling a story, you want to set people up and catch them unaware and get them viscerally connected. So I think in one of the drafts it said, we're just talking about her home life, nothing out of the ordinary or nothing negative. It was saying Grandpa loved the grandchildren, especially when he was masturbating on them. Now, right away, this is going to catch you off guard. This also might shock you, but that's the point. And I know, Dan, you're familiar with this sort of thing because I've read your great book, and that's one of the most shocking things I've ever read. And so we kind of, I don't know where we compromised in the middle on that. But that's part of, stylistically, where I think Frank and I make a good combination. Because he's had so many years in the newspaper business. And I've had, years in broadcast journalism, but more so in the book writing. So I think he tempers me and I push him. So it's a good combination. But Grandpa did all the kids. And as Frank will tell you, the sister, Angie's sister, made a comment that Frank and I were kind of amazed at for a while, and that was, Grandpa stopped doing this with the rest of us about the time you should stop doing that sort of thing. Well, I don't know where it's written in the Grandpa Handbook what age you start doing it, let alone when you stop. And that struck us as being a peculiar statement. And yet, our research showed that when there is incest in the family, where else would it be, that the average length of time that it goes is 3 years, except in those rare cases where it doesn't stop after 3 years and just keeps going. Angie even wound up moving in with Grandpa and was pregnant in high school twice by her grandfather.
Yeah. Now, in continuing in that vein, you talk about how it was, not only did she like the prizes that were and the rewards that her grandfather gave her, and at some point she turn the tables in terms of manipulation, I guess, because she got older. You say that her sexual relationship with her grandfather was longer than most people's marriages. So
it's
tell
true.
Us also about the dynamic in the family. Was it a secret? She told some people. She told three people in total. So you also talk about that as well. Tell us who she told, what was their reaction, and what was the general knowledge of this rape or abuse
Frank confirmed our research. Go ahead, Frank. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, thanks. Well, you know, it was interesting that, you know, first she told her grandmother. And, I mean, within a matter of days, grandma was dead. And then she, you know, told an uncle. Same thing happened. The uncle died. So finally, you know, she's thinking, well, who can I tell that this is going on? And she tells her cousin. And the cousin tells her to drop her pants. He wants to get his piece. And that's the sort of family that this is occurring in. Early on, Angie's sister begged their mother not to leave them with the grandfather. And the mom said no. She had bingo night, and that was the way it was going to be. And, you know, I don't know how this kind of stuff can go on the way that it did and people not know about it. I think
and plus it got to the fact that when she actually moves in with Grandpa and he's buying her, you know.
Yeah, she gets pregnant twice from
they
him.
Might as well have been doing it on the Thanksgiving dinner table. I mean, it was no secret by that point.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely not natural.
And interesting how Angie dealt with it. You
right.
Know,
how does she deal with it, Burl?
In two ways, which is almost stereotypical, and a lot of people have some misunderstandings about this. And that is, she became exceptionally proficient sexually at pleasing her grandfather, and simultaneously very depressed over the situation. She tried to kill herself, I believe, when she was 12 years old, by taking an overdose of over-the-counter medications. She also created this alternate personality, Victoria, which gets mentioned in the book. Victoria, that was the aspect of her personality that was more than happy to fill Angie's shoes, bra, and panties when the grandpa was around. And Angie would disassociate and let Victoria handle everything. And this kind of sets up a pattern. It's important to realize that we're very sympathetic with victims of this type of behavior until they reach puberty or adolescence. Once they start showing their secondary sexual characteristics, we're not sympathetic. The other problem is that no matter how you slice it, no matter who does it, there are physical sensations that are pleasurable. Sex feels good. Even if it's grandpa. So you have this real traumatic situation, which has a long-lasting effect, is that it may be immoral, it may be unwanted, whatever, but it felt good. And it's especially when it starts at an early age, here's something to consider. I don't know if you have kids or not, but I do, and Frank does. Anybody who has children knows you snuggle up with them on the couch, you pet them, you kiss them, you hug them. There's nothing sexual about it. It's just an expression of love and affection. Well, when that same love and affection you get from everybody becomes sexualized by grandpa or by anybody else, the kid can't tell the difference. So that everything in any show of affection can, in the kid's mind, be sexualized. And this becomes a problem when they say liberate a child from a home where there's been incest, and the kid's little, and the kid's with the foster family, and the foster mom hugs the kid, kisses the kid, and the kid starts reaching for her private parts. You go, what's going on here? Because they associate any form of, you know, what would be just normal affection from anybody else in a normal family as being foreplay. So it's really problematic. I mean, we're talking about really lasting damage to kids and their own self-image, because everyone, once it's revealed and people feel sorry for them, oh, you poor thing, they feel guilty about the fact that they enjoyed it physically. That not only did what they do was wrong, but how they felt about it emotionally or physically was wrong. So it doubles the guilt. So it's a real rough situation, right, no matter how you look at it.
Actually, you know, in that vein, I remember doing an interview with a detective who investigated the Night Stalker slayings here in Los Angeles. And during the course of his investigation, he interviewed a surviving victim who had been anally raped by this serial killer. And, you know, this victim was ashamed that there was pleasure in that rape and told the detective that. So, you know, what you're saying, Burl, isn't too far, you know, off the facts the way they are.
Yeah, I read it.
It's just difficult for people to hear.
Yeah, it is difficult for people to hear, and this was the crux. Is that I don't have the reference in front of me, but I consulted several books by sociologists, sexologists, researchers on this exact topic that are written for professionals, you know, not the general public, but, you know, all the research, the interviews, the problems that people face, and this was one of the number one problematic areas, is that people don't want to hear that, you know, and yet that's something that has to be dealt with for the sake of the sanity of the victim.
Now, let's fast forward to age 19. She's, like you say, she's had these suicide attempts and wavers between promiscuity and then depression. So she seems to be of two different characters, obviously. Now, tell us what are the repercussions of this betrayal of her grandparent or her grandfather and of the family itself. What was the repercussions, and what does she do as a result? And we'll talk about Hector Gonzalez, and she's 19. And tell us what she looks like at this age. Is she attractive? What does she look like?
Yeah. Go ahead, Frank.
Well, you know, I mean, as you'll see in the book, anybody that knew Angie when she was about, you know, 18 or 19 saw her as being the neighborhood hottie. And, you know, they all wanted to, all the guys wanted to be with her, to date her. They knew that she was fun. You know, she was very attractive to these folks. And, but, you know, internally, you know, she was still struggling with, you know, what had been going on with her, the fact that she'd been raped, the fact that she'd had these abortions. And she ended up at this young age getting married to, you know, I guess the neighborhood tough kid, right?
The first guy that asked her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Hector Gonzalez. And, you know, it didn't last long. Nothing really was permanent in Angie's life. So it's a pattern that you'll see throughout. And, you know, within months, the marriage was over, and not soon after that, she was off to Florida to join the Air Force.
It was a smart move on her part. And I think it really, you know, in the most ideal situations, it gave her really an entirely new worldview, a whole new level of life and opportunity opened up to her. It was really a fantastic experience for her, I'm sure. Plus, she met a very handsome, wonderful guy who wants to marry her. Of course, he's already knocked her up, but he wants to marry her. And she does marry him. And from, shall we say, societal expectations, she's hit the jackpot. She's married this guy who is kind, he's loving, he's good-looking, he's a good provider, a wonderful father. They have two kids, you know, bang, bang. And everything would seem to be dandy. Except there's that whole aspect of Angie that dandy isn't what gets her, you know. What gets her is, you know, the no-tell motel room with the rusty springs and some guy she hardly knows banging her like a screen door. So, I mean, every time her wonderful husband leaves town on business, she's off with somebody else. You know, she may, in one part of her mind, saying, I want a wonderful, kind, loving husband who'll make love to me. But the other part of it is going, no, you don't. You want it like Grandpa had it. And that becomes a reoccurring problem in her life.
That's the thing that we saw throughout the book, you know, throughout the research, is that and especially in this case where she married this really great guy, as Burl says, that you know, the real great guy didn't do it for her, in spite of the fact that if, you know, you looked at her life, you'd say, oh my God, you hit the jackpot.
Yeah, I mean, my heart really goes out to her ex-husband, because, I mean, it's just, what a horrible thing to have happened to him, to marry this beautiful woman and have two great kids, and him not knowing what's lurking underneath.
Now, what happens with the marriage to Tom Fuller, this great guy with this idyllic life, and she's in the military and succeeding, and they have the two children. So what happens in this relationship?
So the military ultimately ends up bringing them to California. And what many consider to be the most beautiful part of California, the Central Coast, you know, there's wineries there that have some of the finest grapes and the best red wines you can imagine. Beautiful scenery, great place to raise a family. It's not Los Angeles, it's not San Francisco, and it's not, you know, the meth-ravaged California inland. It's just a real nice place. And being in the military brought them there. They had a nice pad. They were doing okay. And one day, they've got two kids. Angie's deciding, you know, take the kids out for a walk. She comes back, puts them to sleep, and an hour later, the youngest of the two is dead. And the death of this child, as it does in many marriages, had a profound effect on the couple. In many, many ways, and reverberated still, I think, through their lives even today. The little girl apparently suffocated in her crib and caused a great deal of grief. Tom Fuller was out of town at the time of the death. Paramedics came. They were unable, you know, obviously, to revive this little girl. And what happened was Angie was insistent that the baby died because she had choked on a pacifier. And it was a defective pacifier that Gerber had recalled. Angie and Tom brought a lawsuit against the Gerber. They had a life insurance policy on the baby. And ultimately, you know, after several years of back and forth, they settled with Gerber for $700,000. Angie got the lion's share of that. They cashed in the life insurance policy that was under $100,000. Angie got the lion's share of that. But the couple was divorced. Tom had moved farther south into inland Southern California, and Angie stayed on the coast and found profligate ways to spend that dough. And not only was she spending it, but she was hanging out with some pretty bad boys, including one that, you know, was a known meth abuser in the small town, a known, you know, gang member type who, you know, she ultimately ended up getting a restraining order against. And that, you know, and that relationship and her lifestyle, even with all that dough, was a far cry within a few months from being, you know, the married mother of two living in idyllic existence on the, you know, beautiful California coast. And it's a weird thing to see happen. And you can imagine how it must have affected her family and friends if it did. Because it just, you know, here you go from the projects to Florida to the best part of California, and all of a sudden, you know, essentially you're back in Section 8 smoking meth with a crackhead gang member.
Right. And yet
situation.
She still had a good deal of money because she did. Well, she did plow through that with some things that were excessive, but she had a beautiful home, and she had gorgeous clothes, gorgeous car, and people looked at her and said, "Wow, this woman's really got it." Well, she got it from the settlement, you know, from Gerber. And as Frank mentioned, what is this? That dichotomy is that half Nelson, is that back and forth, you know. And this is not uncommon. We see this even with people who have been human trafficking victims. There was a class that was done here in L.A. for law enforcement and counselors on the phenomenon. It's not really like Stockholm syndrome, but rather how are you going to keep them down on the farm once they've seen the streets? There's an aspect to that lifestyle that is attractive even in smaller doses. You know, you can rescue someone from a situation. Say, here, you can live with these nice people in this nice house in this nice neighborhood, and the person will run away and go back to hooking around the corner when they don't have to. No one's making them, but, you know, it becomes part of their whatever, fulfill some need. And they say, you can't be mad at them even if they go running back, because that's typical, you know. They're still hooked into the lifestyle somehow.
You know, and it's interesting too, though, that attitudes are changing toward that, I think, for precisely the reasons we're talking about. You know, if you look at law enforcement memos on this stuff today, they don't call people prostitutes and johns and, you know, pimps. They call the, you know, these people to be victims of sexual trafficking and people who are, you know, and on the flip side of it, the criminal side of it, you know, people who are, you know, purveying or sexual traffickers. It sounds like, you know, drug trafficking. It's far less, you know, the words are far less innocuous now. They're a lot more.
Yeah, but there's also another aspect of that is one of the reasons for the, this is going to unnerve some people when I say this, but it's true. One of the reasons for these human trafficking laws is, where do they get applied? They don't get applied to real human traffickers, because that's like trying to go after, you know, the cartels, which is human trafficking is part of the same cartels that do the guns and do the you know, the massive amount of drugs. They go after some poor schmuck who's pimping his cousin Ruth down on the corner, and instead of getting him for you know, pandering or whatever the hell it is, they try to get him with being like he's
Sexual trafficking. That's what they do. And you know, I mean, the thing is that that's it exactly. But it's become, you know, the prostitute used to be seen as somewhat of a criminal, you know, engaged in criminal behavior. And you know, I mean, I used to go on lots of roundups where they would bust these women and take them into jail. And now they, you know, they're more treated as victims, which, you know, I want to like swing it back around to Angie. And, you know, what we're seeing in her behavior, even at this time, is victimized, you know, the behavior of someone who's been victimized. Wouldn't you say, Burl?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's been, I'd just rather use the term traumatized rather than victimized. People don't like being victims. And I'll tell you who this pisses off, if I can use that expression on Blog Talk Radio, is that it also makes an assumption for women who work in the sex trade industry, who are not victims of human trafficking, who make a conscious decision, this is what I want to do for X number of years to make money. And they don't do this so much with men, but it's still a portrayal of women are somehow genetically unable to make decisions about their own lives. That if they decide to do something I don't approve of, they must have been coerced. And there's been research done on this to see if that's what the percentage is of women working in those trades who were coerced, those who have been victims of molestation as children, and that's why they're doing it. And it turns out, no, that's a very small percentage. And the ones who did it because they made a decision to, like I think I'll be a car dealer in Vegas, really don't like to say that, what, I can't make my own decision. You notice that the male prostitutes don't get that same
right. That's a good distinction. And you could even then at that point you could say, you know, how many of these customers are being exploited, right?
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But who's being exploited in the strip clubs? It's not the stripper. It's
yeah,
the customer.
Listen, you and I are on the same page there. I believe that.
Yeah.
But
okay, let's switch gears and introduce Jose Francisco Rodriguez and talk about before he found religion and quit smoking and quit drinking and found Pentecostal religion, evangelical, speaking in tongues. So tell us a little bit about Jose Francisco Rodriguez, please.
So in our book, A Taste for Murder, which is available on Amazon today, we open up with Jose's death. And, you know, Jose Francisco Rodriguez is known to everybody as Frank. And he's kind of the all-American kid. You know, he grew up in a loving family with, you know, loving siblings. He was kind of the leader. He played football in high school. He had, you know, an idea of what would be his future as an adult. And, he worked toward that. He joined the Navy, got married, and had a fairly successful marriage for at least a dozen years, although there were no children. And ultimately, Frank and his first wife got divorced. And that set Frank kind of reeling. It made him lost in a way. And he, you know, sought avenues of medication through, you know, drinking and smoking and, you know, self-destructive things. But ultimately, his path took him to this same part of Central California where Angie and Tom settled, just near Santa Barbara. And he found that he had, you know, some use in life as a counselor to kids. And he became a counselor at one of these youth boot camps. This one was run by the Los Angeles school district for boys mostly. And what they did was they'd bring these kids up there, especially the at-risk kids. They'd run them through the paces of a military-type training and hopefully, you know, instill the values of respect and politeness in a few of them and keep them from, you know, becoming drug dealers and traffickers and pimps and all the other sorts of bad things it might be. And Frank fit right in, and the kids loved him. And so here's this guy who, you know, after a dozen years of marriage and maybe a half dozen years of trying to figure out what he was going to do with himself at 40, he's figured out that he loves working with children. And in this boot camp, not only is he making friends, not only is he exhibiting the skills of a good leader to these kids, but he's also going to meet Angie because her military experience brought her there too. So the two met about the time that Frank became really religious. He became one of these Pentecostal types, and you know the Pentecostal religion runs pretty deep in Southern California. There's a lot of places where you can get some of that old time religion. Frank found it. He, you know, imbued that into his personality. Angie, in the way grifters do, would adapt her personality to the lifestyle of the man that she wanted to get with. So, you know, weeks before she was dating Frank, there was a guy in the boot camp that Angie wanted to date who was into country music and cowboy clothes. So, you know, they see Angie show up wearing cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. Mm-hmm. When that relationship didn't work out and she set her eyes on Frank, next thing you know, she's wearing a crucifix around her neck and carrying the Holy Bible around. And Frank didn't see that disingenuousness in her. He just saw that she was a woman who loved Jesus like he did and had a young child and decided that, you know, maybe this would be a woman that he could settle down with and find the life that he wanted to live.
Now, people did warn him. There were people at work who said, hey, Frank, you know, slow down a little bit. You know, I mean, he was just so smitten. He was ready to, you know, put a ring on it right then. But there were people there who knew that she'd had the hospital with this, you know, cowboy guy and had been, you know, looking like Annie Oakley the week before. And now she's, looking like, what's her name, Rexella Van Impey. So it's a whole different situation. But he was definitely madly in love with her. And if you saw the emails he sends her proclaiming his love, that he just can't wait to spend the rest of his life with her, which, of course, he did, a very short life, then you see that he was blinded by love.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that really stands out is he absolutely thought that he found the, you know, his love match in Angelina.
part of her ruse is also to, in keeping with this religiosity, they agree to stay celibate till they're married.
Yeah, she wasn't too crazy about that. She would complain to her friends that, she wasn't getting any from Frank, but she was getting plenty from other people.
Right. Now,
the vow of celibacy didn't prevent Angie from, finding ways to relieve the sexual tension in her life.
Yeah, and in the lives of others.
Yeah.
Now, Frank has got a history of military training, and to say that he's fairly healthy is an understatement. So he's a health fanatic, according to his friends and family. So tell us exactly how healthy Frank is, because this is very important to this case, obviously.
Well, go ahead. If you want to take this one, Frank, go ahead.
No, that's okay, bro. I'll let you go.
Okay, well, no, he was known for being really taking great care of himself. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he worked out, he was very active. So, when they did the autopsy, this was the big question. They looked at every organ in his body, and this guy was in fantastic shape, 100% perfect health, except for the fact he was dead. There was no physical, there was no failure of anything. His heart, his lungs, his liver, his kidneys, everything was just fine. No brain aneurysms. The guy was in better than perfect health. And if you took the majority of men his age and on a scale, this guy's in the top 1%. He was in perfect physical condition.
That in researching this, that was the most shocking thing to the police and the coroner, was that they looked at all those things that Burl's talking about. And things that you wouldn't even think of, like lungs and veins, looking for anything, signs of, hardening of the arteries or, plaque in the lungs or any of that stuff. Nothing. It's nothing like that. And it's weird.
Yeah, I mean, they were pretty stunned. I mean, they keep retesting and retesting. They buried the body, but there was nothing left in the body. It was just pretty much a shell. They'd taken everything out to study it, to try to figure out how can this guy, who's 100% healthy, be dead.
Well, let's go back to the day in question. And in fact, let's go back to how things progressed in their marriage and their family life. And then we can lead up to the situation, to the incidents that happened just previous to this, her 911 call, her daughter was there. So tell us about a little bit about their life together and either what was happening in their marriage that things went so sour. What was the indication from friends and family about how this marriage was proceeding?
Well, so right after they meet, and it's not too long before Frank proposes, and not too long after that they get married. But the marriage comes with some stipulations. They got to leave Central California and move down to Montebello. It's a city that's just east of Los Angeles, kind of gritty little suburb. Because Frank has taken a job as a school teacher. And so he gets this job. He promises Angelina he's going to, take care of her and her young daughter. They move down to Montebello. They're living in the suburbs, and she hates it. She can't stand it. And this vow of celibacy has now extended. Now she's telling him that she's got to wait. And meantime, every weekend, every Friday afternoon, she takes the daughter from school back up to Santa Barbara so she can hang out with her friends. And she's not really hanging out with her friends. She's, dating her best friend's nephew and sleeping with him on a fairly regular basis and discussing with her best friend and her best friend's family ways in which she might kill Frank. Now, she plays it off as being a joke, but...
the problem was that she keeps portraying this as a joke, but she does it so often that the joke starts to lose its humor. amongst the friends and family. They're going, all right, already with this, you know, killing prank business. Now, they didn't take her seriously, but it wasn't funny anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in the course of that, though, they did tell her a couple of things. One, in one instance, the mother of her friend told Angie that you could kill somebody by feeding them a tea laced with oleander. Now, if you've ever been to California, you've seen oleander. It grows on the side of the freeway, and it has beautiful white and pink flowers, and it's a really great landscaping plant. It's also super poisonous. In fact, deadly poisonous.
It is so deadly that you can't even burn it because the fumes, the smoke from burning oleander will kill you.
Yeah, and we get into some of that in our book about, you know, different historical instances of oleander poisoning, including one that occurred in Los Angeles just a few months before Frank was found dead. So anyway, so they talk a little bit about, you know, creating a tea with oleander. And then later on, Angie's boyfriend up there talks with her and her friend about how you could kill somebody with antifreeze. And in the course of this, they even discuss whether or not they're going to poison a neighbor's dog by dipping hot dogs in antifreeze. Turns out that propylene glycol, or ethylene glycol, which is what makes up antifreeze, is sweet tasting and amazingly looks a lot like Gatorade. So the discussion turns to, well, gosh, what if you mix this with some Gatorade? Maybe that would work. And, you know, they kind of laugh it off. They do take note that this is kind of strange and Angie's asking about this stuff. And one weekend, I don't know. I want to say it's a week before Frank is ultimately dead. Angie's up in Santa Barbara. Frank's at home. And he smells that smell, that unmistakable smell of leaking gas in the house. And he goes and he looks at the oven, and the oven is turned off. Can't figure it out. He calls the gas company. They come over. And that rotten egg smell is coming from the water heater, which has been loosened to the point where it's spewing out, you know, a high volume of methane gas and mercaptan, the smelly stuff, the house. To the point where, you know, if Frank had been a smoker or if he lit the stove or lit a candle, he would have blown himself up and wiped out the house. The one thing the Edison guy, the Southern California gas guy, knows was that it was obvious that this gas line had been intentionally disabled to allow the gas to leak into the house. He even wrote that in his report. Frank didn't really take much notice of it.
Yeah, I always thought that was really fascinating that to hear guys saying someone loosened this. This is not an accident. There is deadly gas, you know, pouring all over you, and yet he lets it slide.
Yeah. I always thought that was interesting too, and it's too bad. You know, nobody can ever go back and ask him, you know, what happened there. But it says right in the report, you know, that it was deliberately loosened. So, anyway.
But he's probably wrestling with, gee, if Angie did that, she wants to kill me. No, Angie wouldn't want to kill me. She's my soulmate sent by the Lord, you know.
Right. So yes. And that's probably exactly, you know, along the lines of what he did. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't go to church on Sunday and pray over the fact that his life had been saved. Because he was that deeply religious and into the, the Pentecostal of faith. So
now, what exactly happens with the? And I, again, this is fascinating that antifreeze is apparently the color of color of Gatorade. So, and it happens to be he's a big sports buff and likes Gatorade, and she and her daughter pick up a lot of Gatorade that day. Of course, her daughter would like some of that, but she says, "No, this is all for Frank." So tell us about the day in question and the Gatorade, just to demonstrate how fast.
Well, you know, first
it's like a week in question,
started.
Really.
Yeah.
And go ahead, Burl.
Oh, I was going to say that first, you know, she tried the oleander business, you know, she'd give him oleander tea. She'd, you know, have some nice burning oleander incense, whatever it was she did. She tried to get him with the oleander, and that made him sick. You know, made him physically ill. And so she did take him to the hospital, and the doctor looks him over and says, well, it appears to be food poisoning. And he's really low on electrolytes and all this. But I'll tell you what, if you you know, take care of him, get him plenty of bed rest and lots of Gatorade to build up his electrolytes, he should be fine in a couple of days. So that's, boy, that's just exactly what she needed to hear. Because the doctor said, you know, give him jug band music, seems to make him feel just fine, you know. Give him the Gatorade. So she, as it says, you know, bought him lots of Gatorade, told her daughter, oh, this is all for Frank, and proceeded to even, you know, have the daughter serve it to him on occasions.
Yeah, this all takes place in the week after the gas leak incident. And it actually begins with Frank taking a trip back to the Central Coast to work for a day at the Angels Gate camp where he originally met Angie. And when he returns home from the camp, he tells her that he's not feeling well. And, of course, this is when she begins administering this this oleander tea and then subsequently the Gatorade. So that's on Wednesday. And Thursday they go to the hospital. Friday night, Frank is in horrific pain and completely, you know, sick. And by, you know, the time Dateline's over at 11 o'clock, Frank's dead. Now, Angie doesn't call in or notice this occurrence until much later, early actually on Saturday morning. And when the police arrive, you know, there's not much to look at. There's a dead guy laying on the floor and a little pool of vomit around his mouth. And you really can't, you know, crime scenes tell you a lot. In this case, there wasn't a lot to be told, at least on first glance. And I think that, you know, that gave Angie some running room.
Yeah, there was no trauma to him. There was, you know, he hadn't been hit in the head or anything. He's just laying on the floor, and she said, well, I fell asleep watching TV in the other room. I came in to check on him, and he's laying on the floor.
Yeah, the police and the ambulance guys, they were struck by her demeanor. They, they were dealing with a woman who, you know, had lost her husband, and many of these guys and girls had seen lots of women who'd lost their husbands. And she didn't seem to have the same amount of grief. She wasn't experiencing grief in the same way that they had seen it so many other times. In fact, in some ways, they found her to be not even grieving, but giving answers that you would expect to hear from someone who is, you know, one of them. You know, a detective or an ambulance driver or somebody
right.
who, you
That's
know,
an
could...
important point because as we were told in our interviews that, you know, it's most common for someone to be almost, you know, in a state of shock over losing a loved one, where it's hard for them to answer questions or even concentrate on hearing the questions. But Angie was, you know, supposedly grieving, but the minute they'd ask her a question, bam, she was like suddenly totally together and could answer the question, you know, without any difficulty whatsoever. That struck them as unusual. But then again, people process grief in different ways. But it did strike them strange that as supposedly overcome with grief she was, she had no trouble understanding the questions and responding to them in complete sentences and that sort of thing.
And this would come into play later on. This reaction, her reaction to death, would come into play when police and detectives began looking at, you know, the big picture of her life and the death of her daughter. And the similarity in terms of her reaction was quite remarkable.
And yet, and if I might say something in her defense here, hypothetically, and that is people who have been traumatized or who have had a head injury, will often have a flat affect or will disassociate in times of crisis to where it looks like they're not emotionally involved when they're actually emotionally overcome. And so instead of like crying and sobbing, they become almost stoic. So that's something that someone could bring up in her defense that, well, based on any other number of things from her past, maybe even the death of her child, the way she protects herself emotionally from being horribly devastated would be to disassociate.
Well, and that, you know, and that could be very well why it was overlooked.
Yeah.
Now, can you explain to the audience, because I think this is important for Angelina, Angie's motivation right after this, the coroner comes in and says this is due to natural causes. Despite natural causes, what's the procedure with a payout from the insurance company? And you talk about a woman named Brenda Schaefer.
So wait, let me stop you real quick. I hate to do this to you, Dan, but the coroner actually didn't say anything. The coroner could have said natural causes, but
that
the coroner
been fine. Yeah.
Actually deferred making a finding as to the cause of death. And because of that, Angie, who had bought a $250,000 insurance policy on Frank 2 weeks before the gas incident and 3 weeks before his death, couldn't cash the life insurance policy. The life insurance agent and the company that managed the premiums said, no way, you need to have a death certificate that says exactly why he died. And the reason for that is that life insurance policies, won't pay on suicide. And, you know, clearly when you have somebody who's in perfect health and suddenly dies, suicide is a possibility. And they're not going to pay the premium, the benefit to the survivor if the survivor is a murderess. And without knowing a cause of death, either of those are possibilities, and life insurance companies are notoriously stingy. So now
and
she's
also,
in a predicament.
Also, even if the coroner could never determine cause of death, after 18 months, the insurance company would have paid out anyway because while all the time they're not paying, that money is garnering interest, costing them more money. So if after 18 months, if the coroner still can't figure out why the person died, they just go ahead and pay it out.
So what does Angie's situation,
18 months?
She had bills. She needed cash. She wanted to get out of that house. And she wasn't going to do it unless she got that payoff. And she wasn't going to get the payoff unless she had the cause of death. And she wasn't going to get the cause of death unless the coroner knew what the heck they were looking for. So she put herself in a catch 22, or maybe a 23, because there's so many different circumstances.
A 24 and a half, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's she tries to be helpful.
And tell us how she also incorporates the angel gate into her theory, and that she tells police about her ideas.
You want to take that, Frank? You want me to roll with it?
You take that one, Burl.
Okay. Well, when she first calls the police department and says, I think my husband was murdered, they don't take her seriously. They chalk that up to very typical of someone who was distraught that their beloved husband has died, and they, you know, it's like a denial mechanism. Well, someone must have killed him. You know, God wouldn't take him from me, you know. Some evil person did this. Well, she nags the cops over this so much that they decide, well, we better look into this. Well, Montebello Police Department really wasn't in a position staff-wise or resource-wise to handle this themselves. So they call in, will be the L.A. Sheriff's Department, is that correct? Is that the proper law enforcement?
Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, right.
Yeah. And so they bring in a couple of detectives to check this out. Well, so now it is being looked at as, gee, maybe she's right. And, hello, you still there?
Yep.
Okay. So she tells them, they ask her, is there anybody who'd have anything against Frank? And the answer is, she tells him, yes, there is a person at Angel's Gate who Frank had caught doing inappropriate sexual things with some of the kids. And he exposed this person and not the way they liked. And this person, therefore, was very vindictive and said that, he'd get even with Frank for making these accusations. And the being is that Frank had gone up to Angel Gate just before he passed away. And according to her, he said, gee, they were so nice to me. They hugged me. They gave me refreshments. They gave me, cookies and milk or whatever, that she was sure that this person must be the one who did something, who poisoned him. But, they ran the toxicology test, and none of your standard poisons came up. So they had no idea what to look for. And Angie said something really brilliant, such as, well, maybe it was those flowers that grow by the side of the road, whatever those things are, which, of course, would be the oleander. Well, they found an oleander tree in the neighbor's yard next to Angie with an oleander branch hanging right over saying, pick me, So they ran the test and found there were traces of oleander in Frank, but not enough to kill him. So they knew there had to be something else.
So how did they proceed from there?
Frank, take it from there.
So what they have to do is they have to figure out a way to keep Angie believing that they're following the path that she wants them to go down. And they draw her into their investigation and defer to her in a way that makes it seem like, she's Murder, She Wrote or Joe Colombo or, TV detective sort of piecing together the, this intricate puzzle that the buffoonish backwater cops really can't put together.
Oh, yeah. She would mock them to her best friend, Palmyra. She'd say, oh, these cops are, like the Keystone Cops. They don't know what they're doing. I have to help them,
And she really believed she was part of their investigation. She really believed that, that she was Kojak or Columbo. And that, of course, at the same time, the murdering Kojak or the murdering Columbo. And she probably watched enough of these shows to think that she was going to outwit them. And they strung her along. They one of the homicide detectives, Joe Bob Holmes, was a fisherman, loved to fish. And if there was ever a great fishing analogy, it's the way that they reel her in, bit by bit. We detail this in the book, and a lot of it is simply just in the dialogue, in the cat and mouse of the dialogue. Ultimately, they tell her, "Look, we're ready to arrest the guy that you believe is the prime suspect, and we need you to come along with us." Boy, I'll tell you what, there's nothing that makes her happier. And you can see why, obviously. In her mind, okay, they're going to arrest this guy. That means she's in the clear. That means she'll get paid on the life insurance policy, and, this whole thing will go away.
Well, they said, well, how did this person, Angel's Gate, know that Frank was going to be there so that they could prepare this poison? So she says, well, I know that they alert people, right? So she had to come up with some proof that they would somehow know, So she sends a fax to the cops. It's supposed to be, from Angel's Gate to, the staff, which has the list of the kind of cleared people who are going to be there that day. And some person's name is scratched out, and Frank Rodriguez's, whatever his name is, put in there. But if you look at the top of a fax, it tells you where it came from, right? And this happens to come from, the Rite Aid or the CVS or whatever, a block from Angie's house.
That part of it is just when you know, right? The reader, you know, okay, this is really not going to turn out well for her.
Yeah, but for her, no, it's not.
She's standing at the front door of her house waiting for the, you know, Joe Bob and Steinwan to show up and take her to, you know, this guy's house and have her witness the arrest. Yeah, just like they do on Columbo. And instead, when they get there, they tell her, you know, okay, turn around, put your hands behind your back. Boom, they hook her up. And she said, what are you doing? Well, we're arresting you for the murder of your husband. And, of course, she breaks down into tears and goes through, you know, this whole dramatic moment of how could you? I didn't kill my husband. You know, I'm going to prove you wrong, and you'll be sorry that you did this. But she's defeated. I mean, she's done. And, you know, it's the culmination of that part of the story, but it's here that the investigation and the book takes a huge turn.
Yeah. This, like I say, whenever you think you've got this figured out, that it can't be any worse or any more bizarre than it already is, you ain't seen nothing yet.
It's exactly right. And so they, you know, what happens is she's in Santa Barbara. And if you know Southern California, Santa Barbara is about 200 miles north of Los Angeles. Maybe not quite that far, but within that range. And so now these detectives got to bring her back to L.A. And when they do, you know, they put her in one of the toughest county jails that they've got. It's not like the regular, you know, county jail for women. It's actually a county jail that's mostly for men. And she's one of 20 women in this facility under, you know, what is, you know, high security in the Los Angeles jail system. And as her case is progressing through the system, she starts finding out more and more about what the cops have. And one of the things that the cops have is witnesses, good witnesses. And the witnesses are the friends, like Palmyra Gorham, who had discussed with Angie methods of poisoning people and knew about, you know, her attempt to kill Frank by unplugging the gas. So now, in Angie's world, there's only one way you can deal with a rat, and that's to kill it. But, you know, how do you do that in the jail?
Yeah, not easy. Now, she does have a conversation with Palmyra where she does her best to convince her not to testify against her. And she tries to use the reasoning that, well, if you testify and you made these suggestions, you're liable to be arrested and charged as a co-conspirator in the murder. But Palmyra wasn't falling for that. She knew better. And so then Angie gets mad, you know. Don't get me wrong, she says, I'm just explaining it to you, you know. And Palmyra's saying, I'm not afraid of this. You know, I'm going to tell the truth. That's when Angie has to try to find a way of bumping Palmyra off.
And finding a way of doing it when she's in what is essentially solitary confinement in the bowels of the L.A. County Twin Towers jail. And she does it in a really interesting way. She begins a friendship with a woman in the cell next to her. And the way they communicate is by talking through the water pipes. So the water pipes run along the wall, and they amplify the sound of the voice through the cement wall. And she begins talking to the woman in the cell next to her and gauging the woman's willingness to hire killers to take out Palmyra. And when she thinks she has a friend in the jail, it turns out, well, maybe she doesn't really.
No, this lady was not impressed. The woman who was in the cell next to her was in there actually for some nonviolent crimes. But she sounded like she probably would know people who were, you know, violent and dangerous. But she said, you know, hey, I may have done some stupid stuff and got arrested for doing stupid stuff, but I've never killed anybody or wanted to kill anybody or tried to kill anybody. You know, this bitch is crazy. So she agrees She goes to the authorities and says, you know, the woman is killed. Thankfully, she wants me to, you know, have her friend killed. So they said, oh, that's wonderful. Here, wear a wire and record the conversations, which she does. And it just gets even stranger from there, as Frank will tell you.
So this is I loved this part of doing our research because, you know, we in doing in writing the book, we got access to tons and tons of court files, and because and primarily because, you know, this is a big case and it's a death penalty case, so the state of California and the county of Los Angeles saved all of their records, and among the records were these huge volumes of transcripts.
Yeah.
A word I can't say. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I can't
that
say,
word.
I can spell it. There's a huge number of these transcripts. And when you read through these transcripts and you read the dialogue and the discussions, at first between Angie and her cellie, and then later on between the cellmate and the sheriff's detectives, you just get some great insight, not only into the jail, but into what is going on with Angie. So the cellmate finds a way to get away from Angie and talk to the sheriff's detectives. And she tells them, she weaves the whole tale. She says, look, and this lady, this crazy bitch in the cell next to me wants to kill a witness in her case. And they're like, okay, right, tell us about it. And well, so the witness proceeds to describe exactly how to get to Palmyra's house, exactly where to find her in the house, and exactly how to kill her. And she says, yeah, Angie told me that you could kill somebody with oleander and antifreeze. And in fact, she said that's how she did her husband. Now, in exchange for arranging this murder, Angie is offering to pay her cell, you know, her co-fellow prisoner or her fellow prisoner's friends out of the life insurance policy that she still hasn't been paid on.
Yeah.
So Sheriff's Department thinks this is really interesting, and they want to find out more. So they send the cellmate back down, and this time she's wearing a wire. And there's a lengthy, probably a five-hour conversation between the two of between Angie and this cellmate, and it's all about Angie's case and her life, and she talks about, you know, how Palmyra had been her friend and now she wasn't, and how she needed to have her killed, and how she wanted her killed, and how you could pull it off. Well,
yeah, but she says
they,
that if you
take,
use the oleander, the antifreeze, you might have to stay there with her while she dies.
Oh, yeah. That's yeah. You're giving away all the good stuff. I hope you folks listening to this go out and buy the book and give us good reviews on Amazon, in spite of the fact that we're revealing everything here. Of course, if you're on here and listening to it, this is a good reason to listen to Dan Zupansky's show because, as you can see, you get a lot of good details into these true crimes. Anyway, back to Angie. So Angie is expecting now that Palmyra is going to be off and that she's going to get out and she'll have to pay, you know, a finder's fee to the guy that does it. And one day she's surprised in jail with a visitor. The visitor is a male. Somehow he's able to get in. She thinks at first that he's a new lawyer. He says, no, I'm not a lawyer. And if you know, if you've ever seen on TV the way that you visit people in jail, there's that glass window. He's got an envelope in his pocket, and he holds out pictures of Palmyra, and she's been shot in the head. And at first, Angie says, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe that you did that. I was just kidding. But it doesn't take too long before you can see the wheels start spinning, and Angie's saying is actually now gleeful. Oh, my God, I'm going to get out. I'm going to be free. I'm going to be able to pay you. I'm going to be able to move back to the Central Coast and get my daughter back and have my life.
She was thrilled and ecstatic to see that picture of Palmyra with a bullet in her head.
Yep. And the thing is that you'll find out that this was completely manufactured. If you read our book, you'll find out how they did it. And this, to me, just like, and actually, and if you watch the special that Investigation Discovery is doing on A Taste for Murder, it'll be on Saturday, 9 o'clock Eastern Pacific, you'll get to see the actual videotape of this instance and several other places where Angie's being interviewed by the police. And it's really just, it's a fascinating study in psychology and behavior. And really, it gives you a great look at the inner workings of a murder investigation that takes a lot of twists and turns. And this one wasn't done yet.
Yeah,
you know what's very powerful is that
something more in this case. It's just so strange.
There's something we have to talk about, and maybe you can hold back some of it. But what comes up at trial is her past behavior, and so we go back to that daughter that she collected the insurance claim on and the Gerber payout. So Frank, tell us what happened. How did police come to the truth about what Angie had done with her own child?
So during the early part of their investigation after her arrest, the police and detectives did what they always do. They served a search warrant on her house. And in going through her paperwork, they came across a letter. And it was a letter from a doctor at Caltech addressed to Angie's and Tom's attorney. And basically it said something along the lines of, hey, you know, the pacifier that your daughter choked on had probably been manipulated in such a way that caused your daughter to choke. And I cannot in good conscience testify at trial that the pacifier was defective. Well, the detectives read this and they knew exactly, you know, it's all this, you know, doctor lingo and stuff. You know, it's thick, and you're not really sure. But they knew what they were looking at. What they were looking at was another murder that they could pin on Angie. And when they looked through all this paperwork in her house, and here's what they saw: this doctor's letter, and they began talking to people around Angie, and they found that she and her husband Tom had been in Michigan a couple months before the little girl died. Tom was from Michigan. Tom's sister looked at the baby that died, and Alicia, and said, hey, you know, that pacifier she has looks an awful lot like this one that Gerber's recalled. Well, you know, Angie files that away in the recesses of Angie's mind and holds on to that pacifier for several months. And it only turns up again on the very same day that the baby dies. So a California criminal trial in a death penalty case is bifurcated. You have a trial for the circumstances of the crime, in this case, a capital murder. And when the jury finds true the fact that the allegation of capital murder has in fact been proved, then there's a second phase in which the defendant is tried for the penalty. In California, the penalty can either be death or life in prison without the possibility of parole. A jury, the same jury that hears the criminal case, hears the penalty phase of a case. The jury in a penalty phase makes the recommendation to the judge as to what should happen. Should the defendant get the death penalty, or should the defendant be sentenced to life? And they make their determination based on two factors, two series of factors. One series of factors would be factors what they call in mitigation, things that would tend to make one less, you know, likely to get the death penalty. Like, for example, the Angie's childhood abuse. You could maybe consider that to be a factor in mitigation, and in fact, her attorneys used that childhood abuse as a way to mitigate the ultimate crime that she did. But the other thing is factors in aggravation. And factors in aggravation are oftentimes things that have never been proven. For example, you know, murders, robberies, those sorts of things, where, you know, maybe you committed these acts, but it was never proven or brought to trial. In this case, they bring up the death of the baby, and they have a mini trial over her death to show that in all likelihood, Angie killed the baby to collect life insurance, like she did with Frank, and settle this lawsuit for, you know, nearly $1 million. And what that does is it aggravates the case. It shows that this is a woman who has a propensity to murder, and not just murder, but murder people who are close to her. So they bring all this up. They bring up the fact of the doctor's letter, and they bring this Caltech doctor into court and have him testify. Now, remember, back in, you know, when little Alicia died, he'd been hired by Tom and Angie's attorney and said he didn't want to do it. Well, now the prosecutor's got him, and the prosecutor, Doug Sortino, now a judge in L.A. County, you know, has him lay out all the things that can happen to a piece of rubber in a pacifier, and, you know, how a piece of rubber can then choke somebody to death, because, you know, esoterically, this guy is all knows everything there is to know about rubber and pacifiers. So he's testifying for the prosecution, and in excruciating molecular detail explains how the pacifier was ripped by a pair of pliers or some other device, and then the rubber part of it shoved down the baby's throat, causing the baby to choke to death and die. Now, you'll remember that we talked about Angie's reaction to the police and the ambulance and the coroner when they showed up at her house after Frank's death. And we talked about how Angie's reaction wasn't something that they had ever seen before or encountered when it came to a grieving widow. Well, it turns out that when little Alicia died, there was a very similar disassociation between Angie and the dead baby. In fact, when the paramedics arrived, Angie was standing out in front of the house waiting for them, and then directed them to the room where the baby was dead in her crib. Now, people that are in the paramedic business and the firefighter business and the coroner business and the business of dealing with other people and grieving mothers will tell you that any mother grieving over her baby, or a baby that's just choked to death or is dead in the crib, isn't going to be standing out in front of the house waiting for the firefighters to show up. That mom's going to be with that baby, holding it, comforting it, crying over it, trying to bring it back to life. Angie wasn't doing any of that. And, you know, I mean, if you consider that, and you consider the how powerful it is to be a mom and have your baby die, and, you know, what the normal circumstances of that would be, and the fact that Angie is not reacting in that way, well, I mean, we looked at what the jurors said after this case, and all of them were convinced that they were dealing with a monster who would kill a baby, a monster who would kill a husband, and a monster who would seek to kill her best friend to not be put to death for doing any of the stuff that she did.
I think this thing is that, as we mentioned in the afterwards, Angie is not normal in quotes. And what's normal? Normal is what you're familiar with, what you're used to. I use the metaphor, whatever you want to call it, that she's like a confused cork in a tempest-tossed ocean. Should she arrive safely on dry land, she'd long for the familiar turmoil of the sea storm. And that's kind of the way it is throughout her life. When things are normal, it's not what resonates with her. You know, I mean, is there a moral to the story? Well, there's a moral to every story, even if we get the moral wrong. I remember someone asked if there was a moral to the movie Titanic, and someone replied, yeah, never trust an old woman with expensive jewelry. But that wasn't the intended, you know, moral of the story. The moral of Angie's story is the sexual abuse of children, even when the abuse is nonviolent and rewarded with gifts and praise, leaves lasting emotional scars manifested later in life. And we don't do these books just to amuse ourselves or for the giant paychecks. But we do these books because we hope in telling these stories we can somehow save lives or make someone's life better or see someone else not go down the same road as either Frank or Angie.
Let's talk about the reality of the death penalty in California, Burl.
Well, the reality of the death penalty is if they use it on you, you have no future crimes. The other reality is you can be here a long, long time on death row. I think the average amount of time is, like 12 to 18 years if they ever get around to doing you. There isn't a fast track, which is probably good. I mean, some people are very eager. Well, once they've been found guilty and sentenced to death, let's nuke them. But I've seen too many cases where someone's been on death row for God knows how many years, and then they're cleared. You know, no, they didn't do it. Here's new evidence, new DNA. What's also surprising and shocking is, we're talking about this with someone who's been on both of our shows, Dan, that's Michael Griesbach, that there are some prosecutors that do not want people coming forward with new evidence or DNA that will cure, or not, you know, cure, but prove that someone was innocent, that they've been wrongfully convicted. And they will fight against that DNA information being brought in. One of the statements I heard was, we didn't need DNA to convict him, so why should we look at it now? That kind of bothers me.
I want to just say this. One, it's been more than 10 years since an inmate was executed in California, a male. And it's been since 1958 since a woman was executed in California. And despite California's burgeoning prison population, there's only, 20 women, I think, on death row. It's not likely that Angie's going to get executed, nor is it likely that she's Stephen Avery, come to life in the form of a very large female.
Oh, God, she is large now. You know, she used to be, when you see the book, you'll see the photographs. She was very, very good looking. Now I'd say she looks like Jabba the Hutt. But I guess that's part of that's the diet they serve you in prison. She's
we touched on it a little bit, but for this person that did come from the projects and also did hang around with bad boys and, like you say, smoking meth, what was her reaction in prison? Or reaction to prison?
She did an interview with the Los Angeles Times about 6 months to a year after her sentence, and she did take a very sort of I didn't do this type of approach to it. But that part of it is she's never going to wiggle out of it. There's no exculpatory evidence.
Oh, yeah,
no
she
proof.
Was even saying that at the last minute she changed her story and said, oh, yes, he killed himself. He committed suicide because our marriage wasn't going well. Oh, come on, we're not falling for that one either.
Yeah, and there's no, there's nothing exculpatory. There's no evil police department here. There's nothing remotely like these, cases we're hearing about more and more, like Adnan and Serial or Stephen Avery making of a murderer. This is a murderer. So she's been in prison, in the state prison, for well over a decade. For a while there, she was online seeking pen pals. At one point, Burl and I wrote to her, and she posted on posted on her pen pal profile, she didn't want to talk to journalists.
Imagine that against journalists.
Yeah, well, I mean,
murderers are okay. Journalists.
Yes, I can't blame her. Think that, we've heard that, she still has, some contact with her family, and she's not completely, adrift and alone. The women on death row are a fairly tight-knit community. They put out a newsletter once a month among themselves, and, each of them knows what each other's story is. And, unfortunately, most of them begin with abuse and end with some horrible crime. The death row in California for women is in a place called Chowchilla. It's about halfway between Los Angeles and Sacramento in what is really a vast wasteland of, cow shit and just, you know, overrun farms that are decimated by this drought. And it's not a place that you want to go visit or a place that you want to live out the rest of your life in. And, you know, to think that you would, in her case, you know, going from the projects to Florida to this beautiful place in Central California and ending up, you know, in the heart of
nothingness,
you know, country music central is just, you know, I guess that's the price you pay.
Yeah. Well, I
has there been any
every day to make her life happy? You know, I don't know what happiness she gets there. Her sister, you know, is unamused because she had asked them for all sorts of things, almost demanding. You know, send me a color TV. You know, send me this, send me that. After a while, I mean, okay, it may be blood thicker than water, but you know, when you got at least one homicide proven, her sister still doesn't believe that Angie killed the kid. But she does believe that Angie killed Frank. It's hard to, you know, your sympathy only goes so far after a while.
What is, has there been any reaction at all that you know of from her about your book?
Well, other than the no journalist comment, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, the book's been out for a couple of days. Number one on Amazon today.
If she gets the book, which she probably will. Psychopaths, sociopaths, love reading about themselves. And quite often the stories they spin, well, for example, on Fatal Beauty, which we talked about on your show previously, Dan.
Sure.
Rhonda Glover fed me all sorts of stuff that didn't pan out, but I printed the reality, you know, what I found in my research. And she sent me a letter saying, your books caused me a lot of trouble here in prison because the other prisoners have read it. They're going, Rhonda, what you told me was a bunch of crap. You know?
Well, you know, I mean, that's probably the fate, you know, that she'll read this. She probably does like to read about herself. I mean, she certainly opened up to that LA Times reporter. And in the course of the penalty phase, she really opened up to a couple of psychologists who, you know, deeply examined her. So I imagine she'll want to, you know, she'll want to read it. I don't think she's going to like the portrait it paints. You know, it's not flattering in any way. And the thing is that, you know, the sad thing about this is that there are real victims in this, including her daughter, her surviving daughter, her, you know, her ex-husband, and her sister, you know, and Angie's sister. As well as, you know, Frank's whole family who, you know, their brother and son was taken from them needlessly. I mean, a real, real tragedy in this case, you know, that just emanates out in waves around anyone who ever touched this woman's life.
Yeah.
Now, we've only got a couple minutes, so let's talk about this is a Wild Blue Press release. So tell us a little bit about Wild Blue Press, the release, where best to get this book, and a little bit more information about you personally. If anybody would like to contact you, Frank, or you, Burl, give us that contact information, please.
Well, sure. We're actually the special that's on Investigation Discovery, Saturday night, 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern time. Frank and I will both be tweeting on Twitter. We certainly will. I thought I saw a putty tat. We'll be, look for the hashtag of whatever that is, Taste for Murder. And during the special, Wild Blue Print, I'll tell you what, Ginger Dawn Harmon, who is a writer herself, just had her first book published, made a great comment, I thought, and that was, she was so impressed that Wild Blue Press participated in the Q&A that we had on Facebook yesterday. And I stopped and realized, you know, she's right. That is impressive for the publisher to participate.
Wild Blue Press is a great publishing house, and I just love that we're associated with them for this book. They did a great editing effort. They've done a fantastic marketing campaign. You know, this special that Burl's talking about on Discovery, It's really something to see. Now, you can follow us at Burl Bear, that's B-A-R-E-R, or at Frank Girardo, that's G-I-R-A-R-D-O-T, on Twitter. And please do, get on Twitter and follow us. And, of course, we'll be happy to tweet at you.
Yeah, we'll tweet at you, all right. You can get the book immediately, if not sooner, by simply going online to Amazon.com or WildBluePress.com. You can get this book as an instant download ebook for Kindle, or you can order it in paperback so you can hold it and snip it and, you know, clutch it to your chest. And if you want your Kindle version autographed, you can go to Authorgraph.com and request an electronic autograph for your Kindle from us. So,
all right. And we will be happy to do that. Happy to do it.
Yeah, audiobook coming soon.
Yes. And you can get it at your bookstore, too, if you want to go down to a local bookstore and order it.
Yeah, there's so many of them.
Absolutely.
And I got to say, if we have time, I just wanted to say a nice word about my co-author. This is the first time I've written a full-length true crime book with another author, a collaborative experience, and I couldn't be more thrilled and delighted.
Well, that's mutual, Burl. Very, very mutual. I just love working with you.
Oh, great. So we'll get rich and famous now for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a great partnership, obviously evidenced by this great book. So thank you very much, gentlemen, Burl Bear and Frank Girardo, for coming on and talking about this book, A Taste for Murder. So I want to thank you very much, gentlemen. Have a great evening.
We'll both be on my show Saturday, and we'll talk about you, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well... Thank you very much, gentlemen. You have a great evening.
Thanks for having us on. Thank you so much. Good night.
Night.
Good night.